I want to talk to you, starting today and for the next couple of lectures, about Edward Whitmont and this chapter from the book Return of the Goddess, which I consider so important. I was introduced to this in the mid-80s, actually the late 80s, by my wife, which was interesting, who was really an expert on feminist religion. And I've been rereading parts of this book ever since. There are very few books that I read over and over and over and over again. This one's about ready to fall apart. There are a number of reasons why I consider it important. But there are also some caveats about this book and about Whitmont himself. So let me talk about Whitmont and the book in the largest context and then sort of work my way into the material. And we'll talk about the general approach he takes. We'll talk about the view of the three levels of consciousness in evolution. And then today, if everything works out, we'll talk about the first level, the magical mind. And I'll spend most of the next 2 days talking about the mythic mind, because we pretty much understand what the rational mind is. We're all stuck in it. So that's not such a big thing to talk about. But there are elements to it that we don't understand precisely because we're stuck in it. So it's not like we're going to ignore it. So first off, about Whitmont. Whitmont was Jewish. And that's only important for one reason. He was Jewish in Vienna. And he was Jewish in Vienna and a doctor in the 1930s, which means he was there when Nazism was rising. He was there when Germany forcibly annexed Austria into itself. He saw what was happening to Jews. He was able to immigrate to the United States because he was Austrian. His parents were born in Poland, and they immigrated to Austria, and then he was born there. The consequence of that was the U.S. quota system allowed Whitmont, the son, in, but not Whitmont, father and mother. They died in a concentration camp, or two concentration camps, I don't know which. He probably didn't know either. This had a big influence on him. Not just that he had to immigrate and leave his home, not just that his parents died in a concentration camp, you would think that'd be enough in itself, but he saw Nazism up close and personal, too personal. And that really had a profound impact on him. And when you read his section in the Consciousness and Evolution about Dionysus, about the myth of the dark god, and he talks a lot about aggression and violence, it seems to me in a certain way he goes a little overboard. He is a little extreme in the way he's expressing this, but only a little. And I think, and that's the reason why. So we have to understand our authors in context. I'll be able to say some things about Joseph Campbell also that are contextual, but not of this character. But when we come to Campbell, I'll talk about him, as I will about Robert Bly. So it's important to understand that every scholar has a certain point of view, which is based upon their education and their personal life and whatnot, as do I. I've been relatively straightforward, I think, about my own background with little bits here and there of things, you know. I didn't sit you down and give you a long bio about where did David come from, how boring would that be. But every once in a while I sort of throw something out there and get an idea how I view things. It's feminist scholarship that has reminded us that we need to do this, that everybody has a point of view. The masculine scholarship of earlier times was stuck in the myth of objectivity, and I use that language not unthoughtfully. I use it very thoughtfully. The idea of disconnected objectivity is a consequence of patriarchal mentality. And the feminist scholarship has reminded everybody that such a thing doesn't exist. We can have collective views of reality that might step beyond the individual. That's what science is. It's a collective view of what's actually going on based upon experiment. It has its own problems because even the collective view has problems if you don't understand the nature of collective mentality, which most scientists don't. So there are issues there too. But there are limits to what we can escape in our own limits. I don't know a better way to phrase that. I mean, and sometimes the only way we know about reality is by understanding our own limits. For example, there is this idea, which I mentioned earlier, about dark matter and dark energy, that most of the universe is dark matter and dark energy. Now, nobody can know what dark matter is. That's why they call it dark matter. I'll just talk about matter for the sake of simplicity. But based upon the whole complex of theories that have been developed about modern cosmology from the physicists and the quantum physicists and the astronomers and all these people, I don't even know what to call half of them anymore with all the various specialties that exist. In order for all their theories to work and explain what's going on, they have to hypothesize the existence of something that they can't know about. Because what they've noticed is that there would have to be a certain amount of matter in the cosmos for the cosmos to be acting the way it is. They don't see it. So they've concluded that there's something out there that they don't see in order to make all their gravitational equations work out. And it turns out that most of the stuff that's out there is stuff they can't know about. That what they can actually know about, I mean, this is scientific right now, what they can actually know about is the minority, the smallest proportion, small proportion of matter and energy in the universe. But based upon that, they hypothesize the existence of something else. It's required. So it's required that there be something outside of what they know in order to make sense of what they know. That's a revolutionary idea. If you go back to early 20th century science, before people like Heisenberg and Einstein and whatnot formulated these ideas, the position was we can know everything. That's a standard patriarchal position. It's interesting that they now come to the realization there's stuff which is absolutely not knowable, but it's there. Now, I'm not going to say that that's a matriarchal position. I'm not sure what it is. We'll come to talking about that. But the original view of we can know everything, objective reality, we got it covered. I got your back, philosophically, as it were. Very patriarchal idea. I'll explain more about this when we come to the mental phase of consciousness. Writ large, the collective mental phase of consciousness of cultures and their views about religion and science and whatnot. So back to Wittmann, though. So we need to understand Wittmann's limits, but we also need to understand that he had a vision of things that was very profound because of the experience he had. It's like the double-edged sword we talk about, that the strength is the weakness, that the virtue is the failing. So Wittmann's virtue is what he saw. Wittmann's limitation comes from what he saw and the mark it left on him. In this case, Nazism, which he understands as a perverse view of the Grail quest, and as something he refers to, and I'm going to get a little advancing here, as... I'm not going to find it, probably. It's always like this when I'm looking for quotations that I haven't marked because I just sort of like, oh, I want to use this quotation. Anyhow, what he says, and although I can't find the quotation, is that when the collective religious mind, if you will, or the collective mind regresses, it's negative. That if you encounter, explore, and express the mythic mind in a regressive way, it has a negative consequence on culture. That it has to be reintegrated rather than simply re-experienced. And you wouldn't imagine this, but he saw Nazism as a negative version of the Grail quest, which has positive characteristics, as he actually, in the later part of the book, suggests that the Grail quest, this old medieval story, is the myth of our times, which is positive, but that the Nazis took a negative take on it. And if you actually look at what the Nazis were about and the mythology of Nazism, you can see the Grail quest in there. There are images of Hitler as a Teutonic knight and all this kind of thing. We're not going to discuss that in this class, but if it really interests you, it's worth looking at. Yeah, Forrest.
What age he was when he emigrated from Austria?
Hi. I don't actually know how old he was when he emigrated.
Okay. You said he was a doctor. So
he was a physician. He was certainly in his 20s, probably the second half of his 20s into the first half of his 30s, but I don't know exactly what his age was. You know, I think that there's a way. Let's look at the publication data here. He was born in 1912, was in the publication date of the book. So in 1932, he was 22. And in 1938, he was 26. So that's probably around the age they emigrated, 26 or 27, thereabouts. So that's old enough to have the good sense to do it and young enough to have the ability to do it and thrive. Anyhow, he became the head of the Jungian Training Institute in New York, a very consequential psychologist in the United States, although in the psych department here, you're never going to hear his name, because these are not things that are of interest to them. So, we okay to proceed then? Okay. So that's the caveat. In the prologue to the material I'm having you read, it's called Consciousness and Evolution. The second paragraph. He says the human brain has been described in its structure as historically layered or triune. It consists first in the neomammalian cortical areas, second beneath that operates the affect or feeling generating limbic system, and third, the still more primitive reptilian brain that is concerned primarily with adaptation and survival. And he goes on to mention some names like Neumann, Gebster, etc. And then he says, we may assume that the psychological development of the individual replicates the evolutionary history of mankind. These people that he's quoting were Jungians who developed the idea that human cultures evolve, and in the evolution of human cultures, you see religions going through systematic changes, and that they track on each other. And so that's the connection of what we're doing in this class. That when humanity and human culture was in a certain period, it expressed itself religiously in a certain way. And as it developed over time, it expressed itself differently in that different period of time. This is a consequence, as he says, of human mind and brain evolving, and he's making a relationship between the two. He's not saying that mind and brain are the same thing, though, right? But he is saying the brain has evolved. We see these three layers in the brain to simplify everything. I don't think that that view has been overturned yet by modern physiological psychology. I think that it would still hold. And he says, so these three layers are concerned with different elements of existence and perceive reality in different ways. And so that's the key thing. So what I called the mythic mind, or he calls the mythic mind rather, or the middle level of the brain, or the middle phase of consciousness in evolution, understands everything associationally in accordance with the syllabus, not the syllabus, the syllogism of in grass that I gave you. The explanation that I gave you was that it's an associationist way of thinking, not a logical, deductive way of thinking. So all religious life that's associated with that level of culture needs to be understood as understanding the world around itself from that level of mentality. So if you wanted to understand myth, say Greek myth, you have to understand that the Greeks were not thinking about things rationally when they were in the mythic phase of their own religious life. They were thinking about things from an associationist point of view. Rationality came later, right? So the myths, Greek myths, preceded people like Aristotle, who systematized logical forms of intellection, and then that followed later. And so you move into a more rational phase later. And so if you want to understand the Christianity of the Reformation, for example, you have to think about it from a point of view of a rational mind as well as a mythic mind, right? But if you want to understand Roman religion or Greek religion, you mostly have to think about it from a mythic point of view. So that's the thing here that's of significance.
He says in the first paragraph, though, even though he's following on the work of Erich Neumann, he says, Neumann, he did not go on to forecast the reappearance of the goddess and her Dionysian companion, who embody desire, neediness, and aggression in both their destructive and consciousness-expanding possibilities. In the light of the dynamic developments of the three decades since his book was published, especially those brought about by the women's movement, who I'm calling feminist scholarship, among other things, this study picks up where Neumann left off. So those are his roots. Okay. Now, what he does then is he points out that, this is on page 40, beneath our rational modern mind lie dormant the earlier ways. The matriarchal, magical, and mythological perception and concept formations, the limbic and reptilian affects, aggression, defense, and survival adaptations. From the standpoint of our most recently acquired neo-mammalian awareness, these earlier strata appear unconscious. In fact, however, they show a sort of consciousness and even intentionality of their own. Ever and again, they prove capable of opposing the rational stance. Again, he's talking about things psychoanalytically, intrapsychically. But if you think about this interpretation from the point of view of a culture and religious life in a culture, what it means is you have this kind of rational level of theology, but underneath it you have a kind of religiousness which is of this mythic associational character and is acting on the basis of its own rules. And beneath that you have something even deeper, which he's calling the magical, and it operates on the basis of its own rules. So if you're trying to understand religious life in any culture that's a modern culture, you have to look at those three elements in the culture and how they either do or don't relate to each other to try and figure out what's going on in that religion. Okay. So an example that I used earlier was Bateson talking about the Protestant Reformation essentially as a conflict between magical, mythic ways of thinking and rational ways of thinking, because the Protestant Reformation did things like reject the Mass, which is a magical operation. And the Hundred Years' War could be understood as a conflict over, are we going to maintain the magical operation of the Mass, or are we going to reject it as superstition? That's a very interesting way to look at religious history. I think it's a very powerful way to look at religious history. But the thing that Wittmann would point out is that even in the rational Protestant mind, there's a deeper level of something going on that needs to be understood if you're really going to understand the religiousness of the modern Protestant mind. And if you think he's wrong, then ask yourself why it is there's a strong evangelical movement in modern Protestantism in the United States. Where does that come from? You know, what does it mean when people stand up and testify that they've been saved with great emotion and then pass out on the floor? What's going on here? There's nothing particularly rational about that. Okay, there's something mythic going on. But Wittmann would also say there's something going on with the mythic mind, but it's not well integrated with the rational mind, that there's a problem here. Okay, so this should give you some idea where we're going with this material. Are we good? Is this making sense? Hold on a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
How did you say that? You said that there was the three layers.
Yeah.
And that's the mythic, the magical, and the
rational. Yeah, rational being the highest.
Rational.
Most recent in the sense of highest in the sense of most recent.
Then it's mythic and then magical at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now it's interesting. This just occurred to me. I don't know why. It just occurred to me. If you look at most of, if you look at Buddhism, for example, Buddhism talks about body, speech, and mind. Actually, the Zoroastrians talk about body, speech, and mind also as the three ways of dividing, as one way you could talk about human experience is to divide it up into the experience of body, the experience of speech, and the experience of mind. Well, that's very interesting because if you think of magical is about the body. If you think of mythic is about speech as if it, it a type of speech, let's say, visual speech. And if you think about mind, you could say it's about rational. Okay. Or you could actually reverse them in interesting ways. Anyhow, that three-way division is something that could be played with. It was just occurring to me this morning that you could play with it. But I haven't worked through it in my own thought entirely. Okay. So let's talk about this magical phase, which is the earliest phase of human mentality. I don't mean mental in the sense of like rational, but consciousness, let's say. It's the earliest stage of human consciousness. And therefore, it's the oldest form of religion that we could know about. It'd be like Stone Age religion or Neolithic religion. So he says a few things that I think are pretty interesting. First off, he defines magical, and this is on page 42. By magical is implied the pre-verbal, unitary, symbiotic identity level of existence or consciousness prior to the arising of mythological imagery or rational thought. So he's defining it by what it isn't, which is probably the only way you can define it, by what it's not. Because it's pretty hard to get at it directly. Most of us can't really get at it in our own experience. And societies who could be characterized as magical pretty much don't exist. So there's a way in which he's doing a lot of hypothesizing here, and it's important to consider this. The ancient magical and mythological levels of our being, though unconscious to our current modus operandi, means method of operating, need to be recognized as vital capacities of ours. If we fail to integrate them with our rational worldview, we are likely to regress into new barbarism rather than take the next step of conscious evolution. This is the quote I was looking for earlier that I couldn't find, naturally, but here it is now. So this is important because what he's saying is that on the cultural, I mean, he's saying this on both the cultural and the individual level, even though he's a psychoanalyst and he's mostly focused on the individual. He understands the individual embedded in culture. Here he's really talking about cultural impacts on the individual. And he's saying the ancient magical and mythological levels of our being a culture then, though unconscious in the way we function as a culture now, I'm reinterpreting, need to be recognized as vital capacities of ours. So psychoanalysts have discovered that if you cut off and repress parts of yourself, all the vitality and energy associated with those parts is gone. It's absent to your life. But if you can reintegrate them, then all that vitality and energy becomes part of your life. By extension, if you have a culture which has cut that off, that culture is dead in a certain way. But if you can reintegrate it, that culture is alive in a certain way. I can't help it. I think of Calvinism when I think about rational religion that's cut itself off from the entire emotional life. It's dead. You go to a Swiss Calvinist religious service in a church in 1700, it's pretty stiff, okay? You go south several hundred miles to Italy, and you go to a Roman church, and it's alive and juicy with symbols and people having emotional experiences. Now, the problem, of course, is one's too rational and the other's too emotional. That's really what he would say. So he argues for an integration. He says, if we fail to integrate them, which is the magical and mythical, with our rational worldview, we are likely to regress into a new barbarism rather than take the next step of conscious evolution. So the question is, what is the next step of conscious evolution? We'll come to this later. But what I want to talk about at the moment is this barbarism that he's talking about. That's what he saw with Nazism. He saw that what the Nazis did was they resurrected these old myths. Right, but they were not integrating themselves. There was a split, something was cut off, or they couldn't have been inhuman in the way in which they were. That's the point that he's making. So culturally, what does that mean? Could this possibly have any relevance in America in the early 21st century? Yes, it could. You just look at the way certain religious movements are trying to gain control of the government, and you'll see the answer to that. We are a Christian nation. Well, it may be the case that most of the people in this country are Christians, but to say we are a Christian nation is to actually violate the fundamental principles of the Constitution, which separates church and state. Now, it says that state will not recognize church, but what it means also in the way in which you've come to interpret it is that in order to have a multiplicity of religions safely in this country, we can't institute a single religion as a state religion. And the forces that want to institute a single religion as a state religion are regressive forces from this point of view. Because you know what they're going to do. They're going to outlaw everything else. You better not be a Muslim in this country if this group of people gets under control and gets control of the state. It's going to be a real problem for lots of people if this happens, okay? Well, this is scary stuff. It's scary because it's undeveloped, right? If you listen to many of the pronouncements of so-called public figures about stuff that's in the Bible, it's downright scary because they're talking about stuff that isn't even in the Bible, let alone anything else. Okay, I'll give you another example of this. It may be the case that there will be a rapture and that all the godly people will be taken up to heaven before the apocalypse. Could be true, but it's not a biblical concept. It was invented by a 19th century American minister. That doesn't make it not true, but to say it's in the Bible is to not know anything about the Bible, right? If that suggests a lack of understanding of one's own heritage, a lack of sophistication. And that lack of understanding and lack of sophistication always has the capacity to be regressive and to be dangerous. Okay. There are people who would like to see a war. It would be great if it were atomic war from their point of view, between Israel and the Muslim peoples of the world. Why? Because that's going to usher in the apocalypse. And that'll be great, because the world's a mess, so let's get rid of the mess. And the best way to get rid of the mess is to have the apocalypse, which John foretold. Not St. John, the disciple of Christ, a different John. They're not the same person, and most of these people don't even know that. So this view is kind of regressive. Atomic war is a good thing because it's going to usher in the apocalypse, and the apocalypse is a good thing because the world's a mess. This is very regressive thinking. This is scary and dangerous thinking, and it's out there very profoundly. Okay. So this is the kind of stuff that Whitmont's talking about when we don't have integration. From the magical point of reference, events, I'm on page 46 here. From the magical point of reference, events are not caused and cannot be rationally planned. So this is very interesting. The magical world is not a causal world. And this is interesting if you think about Buddhism, by the way, and what the Buddha was teaching, because he came into a world that was mythological, early mythological. From the magical point of reference, events are not caused and cannot be rationally planned. They happen as fated manifestations of powerful and unknowable forces beyond man's control. They express inexorable natural forces. They are inevitable, not subject to challenge, change, responsibility, or understanding. One can only invoke, accept, propitiate, and adapt to one's fate. This, of course, is the way a lot of people view the apocalypse, isn't it? It speaks to the fact that it's their magical mind that's at work here. Because the non-magical mind, the rational mind, would say, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this story. There's a problem with this story. There may be an apocalypse, but having an atomic war in the 21st century to usher it in is a good thing? Questionable. Okay. Finally, on page 48, there's a long paragraph here. It's important for us to realize that the magical dynamics, far from being left in the past, this is what I was just saying, are merely overlaid and repressed by our rational mind, yet they continue to function and to influence our feelings and behavior. The blood race magic is reemerging from the depths of the unconscious, and he uses this kind of language because of what he saw with the Nazis. When he talks about blood race, he's talking about eugenic purity, and about people who are inferior because they don't happen to belong to your line of physical evolution and so on and so forth. This is where all the Teutonic myths come from. It's like, you know, the heroes can only be Teutonic. They can only be Aryan, but Aryan is defined by the Nazis, not as defined by scholars. It must be dealt with not by repression, but by integration. Primitive group dynamics emerge in the various isms of our time. This is interesting. Unconsciously and compulsively invading our minds with paranoiac obsessions. Well, we see this, don't we? What may have been natural and acceptable on earlier levels of evolution becomes beastly regression when it invades a collective or individual consciousness that is further along the road of differentiation. The power of the group archetype emerges via particular ideological rationalization. Examples are Hitler and his assertion, good is what benefits Germany. The Ayatollah Khomeini's ideology, infringements upon individual unfoldment, that means human rights, human spiritual rights, in the name of the rights of the state, or the dogmatic Madison Avenue logic that 10,000 buyers can't be wrong. This is the notion that if the majority is always right. So read Heinrich Ibsen's An Enemy of the People to understand where that kind of mentality is. It's a very interesting story. Late 19th century, as my recollection is. This archetypal demand of submission and our archaic willingness are rooted in regions of the old brain and experienced as an urge to abdicate personal responsibility. And then he quotes, I merely obeyed orders, which is what the Nazi war criminals said. Me, I'm not bad. I just obeyed orders. I was a good German. They told me to do it. So I killed those 10,000 people. Unless we consciously confront the magical archetype, it threatens us with regression into primordial primitivity, into an ontologically outdated, hence inferior level. I have to think about the mass dance phenomenon called rave, where people get together and kind of lose their individual sense of themselves. I don't know if raves exist anymore, but in the 80s they did. They're a very big deal in San Francisco, for example. People would get together in essentially a big rock concert, take a bunch of drugs and go nuts in the collective. Enjoyed themselves, you know, because they lost their sense of individuality, because a sense of individuality is a little bit oppressive in some ways, because you have to be responsible. It's much more convenient and enjoyable. And I'm not going to say it's not, right, to merge with the collective in a kind of orgiastic experience. I mean, we know, we see a lot of that in religion, where people are seeking this. And it has an ecstatic quality to it. It can't be denied. But the ecstatic quality comes at the abasement, which is the reduction of individual responsibility. So dangerous stuff happens as a result of that, you know. All kinds of drug addictions came out of those sorts of experiences, not to mention transmission of diseases and so on and so forth.
They still happen.
Do they still happen? Okay.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'm Seattle or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not saying that I'm opposed to this, but what I'm saying is that everyone desires this. I mean, I just got through saying that yesterday the way I dealt with having a rotten day was to sit down and drink a bottle of wine. So I'm not putting myself up on a pedestal and saying that we don't have these needs. I'm just saying that there are dangers that are involved in the needs and that we all experience these things. And to think that we don't is to misunderstand our individual situation. And to think that the collective, national level, social level, cultural level doesn't have these experiences is to miss what's happening at that level. And religions in particular, as expressions of collective mentality, are prone to these particular issues. What is ontologically inferior is evil, says Teilhard. This means Teilhard de Chardin, who's a great philosopher of Christianity, who understood Christianity in an evolutionary context. At the end of the course, we will be reading something by one of his, won't say students, but somebody who's in his line of thought, by the name of Thomas Berry, called The New Story. All right, so Teilhard talks about Christianity as an evolutionary process. The church suppressed him. They didn't like what he had to say, Catholic Church. Danger of the modern isms, social, political, religious, or scientific, lies precisely in their challenge to the hard-won achievements of consciousness and moral responsibility, which were developed during the mythological and mental ages. It is not the case that Wittmann is opposed to the rational mind. he's opposed to non-integration of the rational, mythic, and magical minds. That's what he sees as necessary. So it's not that he's saying patriarchy in itself is negative. He's saying that patriarchy is an evolutionary part of an evolutionary process, and it was necessary for humanity to grow through that process, but let's not get stuck there. That's actually what he's saying. Yet this challenge is also a call toward finding the next step to integration, and this is sort of the big theme of the course. We must use our hard-won rationality. After all, this is a university course. We're talking about this stuff using our rational minds. We must use our hard-won rationality to make sure that the emerging goddess archetype, that's which is emerging from the magical mind, not be used to rationalize magical regression, Nazism, but rather that she may guide to higher levels of human development. Okay, now the problems. So this is sort of a preview of what's coming. We talked about these dualities of the mythic mind, and this is where we're going to pick up tomorrow. We talked about Theseus, who's the hero. So here's an image of him slaying the Minotaur. This is not a very good image of the Minotaur. Here's a better image of the Minotaur, right? So this is man and bull combined, which seems like a real oddity to us. But it speaks to the dual nature of a certain level of consciousness and its religious expression. And where do we see that dual nature? Well, one place where we see it is in the Greek world. Apollo, who is the god of light, the bringer of light-based knowledge, and Dionysus, who is his twin, as it turns out, usually viewed as the god of ecstasy, although Whitmont talks about Dionysus as having darker and more destructive qualities. And here's an image of Dionysus where we can perhaps see that more clearly. This is Dionysus looking pretty fierce and mean. You don't see a lot of these images. He doesn't look like the god of revelry here, does he? He looks like something else is going on. Okay. Now, this relationship of half human, half bull, or human and bull in contradistinction to the Apollonian, the light. So this is now the dark versus the light. We find in some other places. In the Roman world, at the same time as Christianity was developing, there was another religion which has faded out, which we don't know lots and lots about, called Mithraism. It was particularly popular with the Roman military. Mithraism. And here's Mithra, who was originally presumably an Iranian god. He's slaying a bull. So this is a different relationship of man and bull. This can be understood as the hero, the light hero, if you will, overcoming the physical. This is the way it's been interpreted, overcoming biological urges. This would be to say, in the mythic level, light and darkness, and the triumph of light over darkness. And here we have the moon goddess, Luna, who interestingly has horns. There's the moon behind her, but these are clearly horns. Here's the solar god. And then there are other things that are going on here that are very interesting. We're not necessarily sure what to make of. There's a dog here. There's a snake down here. There's a scorpion here. The back side of this image is very interesting, because all the Mithraic religious rituals took place in caves. They had to be underground, which is significant. You had to go underground. So if there weren't any caves nearby, they built subterranean chambers for their churches. So what do we have here? We have what's described as being a banquet. Here is the skin of the bull. Okay.
Here's somebody holding a horn. Here we have the snake again. Here we have someone holding a torch with a caduceus. Something's going on down here. We have Luna. We have Sol, again holding a torch, and we have Mithra. Nobody knows a whole lot about what was going on with this religion because it was a mystery religion. What was going on was secret, right? You were on an insider or you were an outsider, and so they didn't write down a whole lot of stuff about it. But it was a very popular religion at the same time as Christianity was developing. Lasted until 300-500 AD, so the fall of the Roman Empire. So I don't know exactly how, I don't know exactly what happened when Constantine declared Christianity the state religion and the impact that had on Mithraism throughout the empire. That would be a level of scholarship that is kind of beyond me. Okay, so here's another example of the relationship of man and bull, and that's what I wanted to illustrate. In the Buddhist world, the god of light, if you will, is called Manjushri, and here he is holding the sword of wisdom, which has a flame, and here he is with a book. His twin, his brother, is Yamantaka. Here's Yamantaka with one head. Pretty fierce looking. Bull's head, human body. I know it looks a little odd for a human body, but it is a human body. And Yamantaka means the slayer of death, the one that overcomes death. And this is relevant because of what Whitmont tells us about Dionysus and aggression and death. Okay, so here we are in the Buddhist world looking at this, and the person that he overcomes is the Lord of Death, who also has a bull's head and a human body, which is interesting. So there's a whole thing here about why that would be the case and what the Buddhists were doing. And what the Buddhists were doing is they're working out integration. That might have been what the Mithraic traditions were doing. They might have been working out integration also, which is what Whitmont calls for, integrating all the elements of rational, mythic, and magical, but also integrating all the elements in the mythic mind, not keeping them separate. And the problem, of course, the problems arise when you keep them separate. So what happened with the rise of the patriarchy? So here we have the Christian take on this issue, and what we have is Christ being tempted by the devil. All right, and so Christ and the devil are totally separate. The argument that Whitmont's going to make in the chapter on the mythic mind is Dionysus in the ancient Mediterranean world became the devil. And the whole quality in culture and in humanity, which was Dionysian, was repressed and turned into the devil. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that you reject the devil, you don't integrate the devil. How can you integrate the power of evil into yourself, because evil is attached to that? Here's another example of the temptation of Christ by the devil. So the problem is, and the difficulty that we face, is because evil is associated with the devil and the Christ, because the devil and evil are related to each other. The devil is the evil one, and everything associated with the devil is evil, and the devil is associated with everything that's associated with the earth, Dionysian qualities, revelry, and, as it turns out, the feminine. How do you integrate all that stuff if you're a modern person when you see this as being evil? All right? But see, Dionysus wasn't evil. The devil may be evil, but Dionysus wasn't evil. So this is the problem that moderns face from Whitmont's point of view. Difficult problem. The Buddhists have a whole different take on it, and after we work our way through this material, we'll come back to the Buddhists on this issue, because they have a way of working it out, because there's no Christian heritage of vast separation like this in the Buddhist world.